Appreciate that. There's a severe judgment coming upon me by someone here. All right. A key part of this chapter is also the reasons why. As you study the Bible, God tells us many things, normally tells us why. There may be some cases where we wonder, well, why? Why has God said this? Why is He doing this? But for the most part, He's pretty well told us why He requires what He does or why He has done things that He has done. And certainly, in this case, He takes time in this chapter to say, I'm going to execute judgment, and here's why I'm doing it. You could summarize this in rebellion, disobedience. Notice here again, committed abomination, especially in regards to idolatry. You study the Old Testament, you cannot but be impressed with the fact that God hated idolatry. The book of Hosea is so graphic, where he's trying to go take a wife who's a harlot. God did that just to depict how strong his hatred is for that. Lamentations 4:6, this book written by which prophet? And what was his, what's this book about? What is he lamenting? The destruction of Jerusalem, the imminent destruction of Jerusalem. And Jeremiah says in that passage, he says that their iniquity is greater than the sin of Sodom. Pretty strong statement. That's how God depicts his people, the people in his sanctuary, the priests, the people of Judah and Jerusalem. And we think of Sodom and Gomorrah being so bad, but God says their sin is greater than that of Sodom and Gomorrah. So we begin to understand why in several places in this section of Ezekiel, God says, I'm executing judgment, I'm not going to have any pity. It would be a very interesting comment. The result being that it would become a reproach. Isaiah in a passage said they will become a hissing among the people. And so here are the people of God. Through the ages of time, people looked to them. They feared Israel because they knew they were God's people. We see some very terse comments about that by some of the kings and nations. Now here are the people of God, the people of Israel. But now God's people will become a reproach. So chapter 5 is just a declaration that I will execute judgment. We use the expression today, let there be no mistake about it. Very common expression we use. So God basically is saying that here. The judgment is coming. In the last chapter, I introduced the reason why. Chapter 6 are some verses that just simply tell us exactly why. It's the abomination. It's a word that we don't use very much today. What does that word mean to you? The word abomination, Charles. When you think about abomination, what comes to mind? It's just something vile, isn't it? Very despicable. It's almost something that's sickening. So in the eyes of God, he said, these things are abominations. It was sickening to God to look down and see what was happening when he talks about, when we talk about his sanctuary, what do we take that to mean? And we're going to see that word. A sanctuary is what, by definition? What is a sanctuary? All right. It's a dwelling place. It's a safe place. And going back to the days of the ark, where did God dwell? Very key in our lesson today. Where did God's presence dwell? First in the Ark of Covenant, later on we're at. After Solomon built the temple, then in the temple. So that's a key point to remember in our studies, that when we talk about God's presence, that's where God is depicted as being. The Ark of Covenant, then in the temple after it was built by Solomon. So we got instruction going all the way back to Deuteronomy chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, as to what should take place, how the temple of God should be guarded, be protected, how there should be no idolatry. So some clear statements back in that passage, just a reference for you. When you look at this period of time, Josiah's reforms had come and gone, right? So Jeremiah began prophesying during the last days of Josiah. Of course, Ezekiel had not started yet. But how would you depict Josiah's reforms? Were they successful? One would say yes, on one regard. Were they fairly wide sweeping? Very much so. But how would you describe the lasting effects, Jimmy? All right, Don, good way to say it. They fell back into their old ways. Many things will affect a generation. Now, the next generation, very little impact. We see that in life, and we see that in the Scriptures and the history of Israel. So a generation passes, another generation passes. The reforms are forgotten about. And thus the admonition back in Deuteronomy chapter 6, for each generation to train up the next generation. As I was studying this over the past few weeks, in July 25th, I moved down here 30 years ago. And I thought about this as we think about the necessity to teach generations. What I see now at Eastside, I see the next generation of a number of families. Those, when I came 30 years ago, were young, right, Lee and Cheryl? A number of them were young. And now that's the next generation. That's the way it should be. That's God's design that this happens. So as I look at this, I ought to have a number of people sitting here who now have children. And they're in classes. They're learning. And they've been taught this love for God. And so we've demonstrated here, in many cases, those aspects of the book of Deuteronomy chapter 6. But that's normally not so. And that was not so back in this day and time. We look in the Old Testament, mountains are high places, normally associated with what? Idolatry. So we're not going to spend a lot of time on that. So we accept a fact in our studies. He said, I'm going to bring a sword and destroy your high place. Your altar shall become desolate. Your sun images shall be broken. I find two or three times it's interesting. He said, I want to cast your slain men before your idols. Not sure what the meaning is there, except maybe it's just a demonstration of God. Your idols are powerless. And here is the end result. It's going to bring death. And again, here I will lay the dead body of the children of Israel before their idols. Scatter your bones round about your altars. So I just highlight how many times in this that he makes a repetitive point. I'm going to break down your idols. So this shows God's disdain for the idolatrous worship that they had been practicing almost from the time they left Egypt. Almost from the time they left Egypt. You think about all the history. You've been in these, as you studied up this point in the Old Testament, it's almost been continual as they've worshiped the gods round about them. Well, some of the very basic thing God told them not to do, they did. Interesting statement here in verse 9. He said, remember among the nations whither should be carried captive, how that I have been broken with their lewd heart. I've been broken with their lewd heart. Now, even though God is saying, I don't have any pity, this statement here, I think, is a very touching statement. Because God said, I've been broken. In other words, God has been touched. Now, he's been hurt that his people have turned away from him. So I found this verse here to be fairly interesting. Verse 10, I have not said in vain that I would do this evil unto them. Does God ever speak in vain? He does not. What a lesson for us to learn. God never speaks in vain. Oftentimes, how many times, I didn't count, and even in these chapters, he says this or a form of this, and they shall know that I am Jehovah. There will be no mistake about it. All right, destruction comes. Interesting here, what I've highlighted, it says an end, and end has come upon the four corners of the land. Again, an expression you find in the book of Revelation, four corners. Now the end has come. Just repetitive times here. I will bring upon thee all thine abominations. Why is the end coming? Because of their abominations. It's going to come back to roost. We use that expression today. Verse 6 again. An end has come. Thy doom is coming to thee. I will surely pour out my wrath upon thee. I think of Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego standing before King Nebuchadnezzar. And he said, I'm going to bring out all my fury upon you. It's just unimaginable that to have God speak to me in a very direct way. If he sent Ezekiel to me and said, Jerry, here's what I'm going to do. It's a very frightening passage. I think that's the intent of this here in this chapter. All hands shall be feeble, knees shall be weak as water. Notice verse 18, and horror shall cover them. Even the horror of seeing the Chaldean army for 2 years, the city is surrounded. You watch your children die of famine. Apparently some might even be tempted or eat their children. And so here's a horror of the judgment that's going to come upon Jerusalem. Verse 19, a very interesting passage. Their silver and gold become meaningless. They cast it in the street. They can't save them. Today we use what expression about our money? We say what? You can't take it with you. Exactly. The very thought I think about when I see this passage. What good is all this silver and gold? And he points out that was part of their downfall. So it's the materialism that was present then. We got materialism still today. So here's a good passage anytime we study. Couple it back with 1 Timothy chapter 6, with Paul's comments, 1 Timothy 6, about the riches, about where you have true value, what brings true value, etc. Verse 21, we understand this. I will give it into the hands of the strangers for a prey, and to the wicked of the earth for a spoil, and they shall profane my secret place. Secret place probably means the temple. You look at 2 Chronicles 36, and that's exactly what happened. King Nebuchadnezzar's army came in. They went in the temple. They took away the vessels of gold during the destruction of Jerusalem in 586. So no intrinsic value to them at this point in time. This point here, they disregarded what the prophets have said. Jeremiah had spoken to them, pleaded with them before the destruction. They didn't pay attention to Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 6 would be a very good reference to jot down in this regard. When things get bad, what do we do sometimes? When we disregard God, but we get in hard times, what do we tend to do, Justin? Ask when we want to pray. We forget God, much as they do, if we're honest with ourselves, and we get busy. We don't study as we ought to. We don't pray as we ought to. Hard times come. Then all of a sudden, then we feel the need. And he says, this is going to happen to you, but the law is going to be gone. The priest is going to be gone. The council of the prophet is going to be gone. So there will be no one there to help you. They've been there. I've provided the help, but you turn your back on them. So when this day has come, it's not going to be there. I simply point out a couple things here relevant to this section. One, from Jeremiah 29, we know there was communication between those in captivity and those back in Jerusalem. So Ezekiel would have had knowledge, or could have had knowledge of things that were happening back there. And also 1 Kings 8, 10 through 11, when Solomon completed the temple, it said the glory of the Lord filled the temple. So for this section of Ezekiel, it's a very key statement. God's glory filled the temple. God went into the temple with His presence. But now we're going to see what's going to happen with the glory of God. So now, chapter 8, he's taken in visions to Jerusalem. I think Edwin didn't really go to Jerusalem. One might debate that, but in a vision, he's taken to Jerusalem. And he's going to see what has happened in this city. So he goes in north, maybe the upper gate. And it says, the altar of this image of jealousy in the entry. Some idolatrous image that would provoke God to jealousy. So what do you see? So here is basically the court, the temple of God. So what do you see? And he says, I see the great abominations the house of Israel do commit here. And God says, why should I not go to my sanctuary? So here's a question posed. They made a complete abomination of my temple, of my sanctuary. Why should I not go from my sanctuary? And you come to chapter 11, 23, a very clear statement that takes place. So in this message to Ezekiel, he introduced the thought here. Later he comes back and answers that. So here he finds a hole in the wall. He digs. He looks in at a door. And he says, you go in and see. And so he gives Ezekiel this instruction. Go see what they're doing. And so in the vision, he goes in and he sees all forms of creeping things, abominable beasts, idols portrayed upon the walls. And so you think in your mind about pictures you've seen of the animals on the wall, things that they might worship. The creeping things, all the idolatry. So in this vision, that's what he has shown in the temple of God. Filled with the idols. Women weeping for Tammuz. A lot of discussion about who or what that might be. Suffice to say, an idol that they worship. I know this a couple times. Thou shalt again see yet greater abominations of these. Well, how can it get any worse? He said, I'm going to show you something even worse than this. Verse 16, significant. He brought me in the inner court of Jehovah's house. So you see that nothing was sacred. And now you hear, you picture men, these 25 men in the temple of God. And what do? Which way do they face? They face the east. They turn their back. If here perhaps is the altar, they turn their backs literally and they face the east and worship the sun gods. So a picture of them in the temple of God, literally turning their backs on God, on the worship that He had intended for them, and they face toward the east to worship. And so we see that expression, we use the expression yet today, that when we turn our backs on someone, that's literally what's depicted here. Chapter 9 is just a short chapter. It's a very frightening chapter. They were afraid of the sword. They were afraid of slaughter. If we live in that period or even many, many years later, we would better understand this. Some people in the world today still understand this because they live with slaughter. I worked in North Carolina for a number of years with a group, and the boys from Somalia, was it? The boy, what, that town? That country, anyway. I talked to them, and the armies came in, and they saw their father's mother's brother's sister slaughtered as they were running out. They saw that. And so even they're in the States now. And the High Point, North Carolina area had a lot of them living there where they came. So they understand this. If they were looking at scriptures, fear would come in their heart when they think about, boy, there's going to be a slaughter, armies coming, because they saw it happen in their lifetime. So this is not too far removed. This goes back about within the last 20, 25 years. Sitting here today, we have a little more difficulty with this. Pretty interesting here. He says, he calls the six men with the swords, maybe a battle axe. He calls a man with an inkhorn. And he says, you go place a mark on the forehead. What does that sound like? Revelation said, now here's the reverse. In Revelation, the mark of the beast was one who would worship the beast. Here's just the opposite. So you see the same symbol used, same idea, but just the opposite. In this case, he says, you put a mark in front of those who mourn for the abomination. They don't feel sorry for themselves what's coming. They actually are mournful for what the abomination, what's taking place. They don't agree. They're sorrowful for that. Notice here, let not your eyes spare, neither have ye pity. Slay utterly the old man, the young man, the virgin, little children, and women. Here again, this idea, God will judge them without pity. And notice where he says begin. He says, you begin at my sanctuary. It's the only thing I want you to clean house, and I want you to start right here. He started the temple. Defile the house, fill the courts with a sling. Again, verse 10, mine eyes shall not spare, neither will I have pity. Why do we repeat something? When you talk to your children, why do you repeat something, Matt? I appreciate that. That's exactly. It's something important, right? You're trying to get a point across, and so we see that here. I will not spare. So now they go about the city, the man in linen comes back, gives his report. I have done as thou commanded me. The message here is, here's a vision, and it's done. So the message here is, I'm going to execute judgment upon Jerusalem, and this is now presented as though it has taken place. So it's not something that may happen. It's presented as, here's what God says He's going to do, and now it has been done. Chapter 10 and also a verse from chapter 11, very significant. The main point in chapter 10, it goes back to the point we made earlier in 1 Kings. When Solomon finished the temple, God's presence came into the temple. That's where the people would commune with God. So God's presence was there. Well, now what Ezekiel is being shown is that God's presence is going to depart from the temple. We saw back in the earlier chapter. Why should I not leave my sanctuary? Give me a reason why I should maintain my presence here, because all the people have forsaken me. But basically, give me a reason why I should not do this. And of course, he does this. It says, the glory of Jehovah went forth from over the threshold of the house and stood by the cherubim. Almost like this is the first step. He just backs away from being in the most holy place. And so we see God's presence removing itself from the temple, from Jerusalem, and from the people of Israel. It goes back to the very early times when God told them, He said, I'll make a covenant with you. He said, I'll be your God if what? You keep my commandments. I'll be your God, you'll be my people. But there were the conditions. Well, they failed. The conditions have not been met for generation after generation. Finally, God said, that's enough. I've had all I'm going to take. Judgment is coming. And now He said He's removing His presence from the temple, from Jerusalem, and from His people at this point in time. Verse 23 of chapter 11, I enter here. The glory of Jehovah went up in the midst of the city and stood upon the mountain, which is on the east side of the city. So in your mind, you see back to what you studied with Trevor Wednesday night. Ezekiel sees the glory of God described there in chapter 1. In all that great grandeur and detail. What I see in my feeble mind, I see all that Ezekiel saw in chapter 1. All the wheels turning and all the glory of God is now exiting the temple and goes up the mountaintop. That's what my mind sees. So God's presence. We've been given a picture of the glory of God back in chapter 1. And now that's being removed and goes to the mountaintop. So there's a message of chapter 10. God's presence departs from the temple. You come in the book of Revelation, chapter 3. What does God say there about the lampstands? He says, I'll come and do what? I'll come and remove your lampstand. Talks to seven churches, remember? Unless you mend your ways, depending on what that various church had to do, I'll come and I'll remove your lampstand. And so that's what we see very similar here. Finally, the last question, chapter 11. The question is asked, will you bring a full end upon Israel? As he's speaking, Pethahiah falls down dead, and that startles apparently Ezekiel. And he says, are you going to kill everyone? And so as he saw the slaughter back in chapter 9, he sees God's presence leaving. He hears God say, I'm not going to spare, I'm not going to have pity. We understand why Ezekiel asks this question. Well, are you going to make a complete end of Israel? And so that's sort of the question that is asked and answered here. He says, you have feared the sword, I'll bring it upon you. But now note verse 9. And I will bring you forth out of the midst thereof and deliver you into the hands of strangers. Going into captivity, right? So there is going to be a remnant that's going to be spared. And ye shall know that I am Jehovah. And here's a question, verse 13. Will thou make a full end of the remnant? Here's his answer. I have removed them far off from among the nations, and whereas I have scattered them among the country, yet will I be to them a sanctuary for a little while in a country to where they are come. So he's saying, while they're away in Babylon, I have not forsaken my people. This handful, this remnant, has been taken into captivity. He says, I'll still be with them, I haven't forgotten them, and I'm going to bring them back. And we've seen that before in other prophecies we've studied. Verse 17, I will gather you from the peoples and assemble you out of the country to where have you been scattered, and I will give you the land of Israel. So here's a promise of the return. We see the captivity, and now we see the promise of the return. Very common with prophecies. Here's a judgment of God, but here's hope. You see that many times in the Old Testament prophets. And you see that here in this particular passage. All right? So hopefully as you look at those chapters, you walk away saying, yes, I think I can understand that. And I think I can take some great lessons there, and I can teach those lessons. Even fairly young people, there's some great lessons there you can draw upon and teach those lessons. All right? Appreciate your attention. Parting comment, anyone? Oh, questions? Oh, thank you. Chapter 6.
Yeah, I thought about it in chapter 6, where you're saying over and over again, they shall know that I am the Lord. Kind of reminded me of what happened back in Egypt. The Pharaoh said, I don't know who God is. God said, I'm going to bring these judgments, and you're going to know who I am and the people of Israel. And Egypt is going to know.
I don't know.
So now he's having to tell that to his own people.
Good point. Something that shouldn't be necessary, right?
Yes.
All right, very good.